Let's start with a little review from last week, because we're just going to jump right in where we left off. Last week, we started to talk about the human condition in terms of being exiles. If you remember, we talked about that as a theme, like where are places that we can find that in the Bible? What does it mean to be an exile? Because that's not a common experience to us living here in North America today. For those of us that are in Jesus, the experience of being in exile is a bittersweet existence. Remember, we related it to the exiles that return from Babylon and go back to Judah and begin to rebuild the temple. And we exist within this creation that was made for us to exist in. And so, in a way, it is our home, but at the same time, it's not as it should be. It's just a shadow of its former glory and what it's going to be in fulfillment. And so we see all this corruption and decay around us, and we grieve for that. That grieves us. There's a lot of suffering and things, effects of sin and death that we see around us. And at the same time, the sweet side of the bittersweet is that the kingdom has been inaugurated and that it's continuing to increase. And it's never going to go backwards. It's only going to go forward. It's only going to increase and fill the earth more and more until it is completely fulfilled. And we can see those things happening around us and in our midst. And for that, we have reason to celebrate. So we're in this kind of bittersweet, we're in this tension as exiles during our time here on earth. And if you think about this enough, at least for me, because I'm kind of a linear thinker, so I think if A is true and you add it to B, then what does that mean? That what is C? To me, I think about these things and I think, well, what does that mean for tomorrow or for right now? All of these things should have real implications for my life. And what are those implications? So that's what we're going to talk about today is, what do we do? How do we live faithfully as exiles? It's difficult oftentimes to come by concise answers, but we can talk about some guiding principles for how we live as exiles. And I think we'll start with Daniel, because wow, what an example of someone who lived through exile. I feel like so many times up here, we're talking about what we would call like our biblical heroes. You know, I talked a lot about Jonah. BJ has talked about Moses and those types of leaders, Abraham. And so we see them do these good and awesome things, and we read their stories, and we also see them just like fail and do things that they weren't supposed to do. And as I read through Daniel's account, Daniel's not that guy. Like, not every single second of his life is recorded, but what is recorded is him just being really faithful in exile and telling the stories of others that were also very, very faithful during their time in exile. So let's take a look at him starting here in Daniel chapter 1. Then the king told Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom there was no impairment, who were good-looking, suitable for instruction and every kind of expertise, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability to serve in the king's court. And he ordered Ashpenaz to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king also allotted for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and ordered that they be educated for 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. So Daniel is a part of, he's in Judah, and he's a part of the people that's carried away when Babylon comes and conquers Judah. And so he's taken into exile into Babylon, and this is Daniel's lot. He ends up in this curious position where they're really trying to assimilate him. It's not a melting pot. It's a, now you're a Babylonian, forget everything you knew before. So we're going to teach you a new language. And this is now the language that you speak. Forget your old one. And Daniel is educated in the royal system of Babylon. Remember, the epitome of evil, the city of blood is Babylon. And Daniel's being educated for 3 years in their system so that he can serve their king, so he can serve Nebuchadnezzar. this wicked king. And so Daniel's efforts and his talents and all of those things are going to go to benefit this kingdom of Babylon that's carried them off into exile. And so he's in this peculiar position that's meant to assimilate him and get him to leave behind all of his old ways. And I think one of the most drastic things that really stood out to me as I read this is that they changed Daniel's name. His name's changed from Daniel, which means God is my judge. What a great name, right? And it's changed to Belshazzar, meaning Baal protect him. How much have we talked about Baal here? Quite a bit. I mean, wow, what a drastic change. I mean, forget your gods, forget your God, forget all of that. And now this is your name, Baal protect him. Can you imagine going through that as a Christian? Someone trying to rip something away from you so violently that they change your name to that degree. And this is just another attempt at assimilating him into the Babylonian way of life. And yet, on those points, Daniel doesn't resist. You know, we don't have an account of Daniel saying, absolutely not. You cannot call me that. I am not going to serve this wicked king who hauled off my people. That's not what happens. And as I wrote this out, I started thinking about Jonah. I thought back to Jonah. Do you guys remember how disgusted Jonah was with the Assyrian people? And they hadn't even come and carried him away. They had just taken some of the land that he had prophesied an expansion on. And he was so disgusted with them and so bitter just about that, that he couldn't even be used for Yahweh's purposes in the world. I mean, that was an obstacle to God working through him to bring people to the knowledge of himself. And so I think about Daniel, who isn't just trusting in his self-righteousness and saying, oh, these disgusting people, I'm not going to do any of this. Daniel's actually being more faithful than Jonah was in his story with his presumed self-righteousness. Daniel's really being faithful here. He doesn't resist on these points. And I think a big difference between Daniel and Jonah is that Daniel was humble. He was a very humble man. And if you look at his account and go forward to chapter 9, you can see it in the way that he prays. You can go and you can look at Jonah's prayer and you can look at Daniel's prayer. And Daniel, he includes himself in this like national prayer of repentance for all of Israel. He says, we have sinned against you. He doesn't exclude himself and say, all of these failures have sinned against you and I am the one standing in the gap. He doesn't do that. He said, it's us. We're doing it. We have done it. And he sees beyond the conflict of two nations, Babylon and Judah. He sees beyond that to the purposes of Yahweh. And he knows we're in this captivity because we broke the covenant. And this is a consequence of doing that. And you told us it was going to happen. And this is our fault. And you did this because you're righteous. He doesn't get lost in the humanity of the whole thing and just hate Babylon because he knows the purposes of Yahweh. That's what he's got his eyes fixed on. So Daniel's humble, and that really sets him apart. So let's look at the flip side of the faithfulness coin. So we saw the ways that he didn't resist, he didn't disrupt and create a big stink about things, but he does draw the line in some places. Later on in chapter 1, remember we talked about the king's food and the king's wine. Let's see what Daniel says about that. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. The commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has allotted your food and your drink, for why should he see your faces looking gaunt in comparison to the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please put your servants to the test for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearances be examined in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So Daniel does draw the line here. And if you continue to read the story, you'll find that God grants Daniel favor. And he looks even better. He and his friends look even better than the young men who are eating the king's choice food and drinking the king's choice wine, because God grants them favor. So he does draw this line when it comes to defiling himself through dietary practices. Because the Babylonians, it's quite possible they were eating meat that wasn't okay for these guys to eat, like pork and things like that. Or maybe it was meat that was slaughtered in ways that weren't according to the instructions that were lined out in Torah. And it also could be that both the meat and the wine had most likely been offered in sacrifice to idols. Any of those above things, these are covenant issues to Daniel. And he's just like, I'm not going to do that. That's a line that I will not cross. And but he brings that up, and he does that in a way that's not disruptive. And God gives him favor, and he is able to honor his relationship and his devotion and allegiance to Yahweh. So what I want to highlight of these two stories is that faithfulness is in exile is often not like a simple formula. There's like a tension that exists between subversion and not doing the things asked of you, and also loyalty and obedience and those types of things. It doesn't look like you just cloistering yourself away from all of the culture and all of the things, and I'm just going to be over here and do my thing. And it also doesn't look like you just assimilating into everything that comes your way and just doing whatever everyone else is doing. It's neither of those two things. I think what it really comes down to is faithfulness in exile looks like seeing through earthly power, whatever that power is, wherever you are, and living with an understanding of who the king is and what the kingdom is that we belong to. We've got to see through all the stuff that looks like power, all the stuff that looks like king, and see to the real thing. And that takes some doing. Like, we have to remind ourselves of what's really going on here and who we really submit to. The first chapter of Daniel, it tells us, we read that he's taken away to Babylon when he was a young man. So biblical historians put his age around 15 when he was taken into exile in Babylon. And he lives through the entirety of the exile until King Cyrus in 539 BC, and probably even beyond that to the time when the exiles were allowed to return to Jerusalem. And in a lot of Bible stories and stuff about the lion's den, Daniel's often portrayed as like a really young man, just being thrown into the lion's den. But he was 82 years old when that happened. He wasn't young when he was thrown into the lion's den. He was most likely about 82 years old because he was a young man when he got there. And then when you look at all the different kings that happened and stuff, by that point, it's like Medo-Persian. And so some time had passed when that had happened. Daniel had already basically lived a lifetime of faithfulness and exile. I mean, can you imagine what that would be like? Like, first of all, you get carried away from your home. You are immersed in a completely different culture that does not honor your God, that you love and adore with your whole self. And you resist all of these calls to worship things, like to bow down to a statue. You see your friends resist these things. You do all of this with this hope inside of you that you'll be delivered, that your people will be delivered. And you live your whole life doing that. You do that, and you do that, and you do that. And you just see power over you passed from one God-hating kingdom to the next one. And that's how you live your life. And you're still faithful. And you're not bitter. And you're not disgusted. I mean, that's Daniel. He's refusing to worship the idol the king set up. He's going before Nebuchadnezzar, a king that had people killed just for inconveniencing him, for being an annoyance. You remember the writing on the wall, the disembodied hand that writes on the wall, and Daniel comes and tells the tells King Belshazzar what it means. He rebukes him. He's forceful. He's bold in what he says. And it's Daniel that meditates on the word of the prophet Jeremiah and understands the time of the exile and that it's coming close to the end. And from that place of understanding and discerning, he prays, he intercedes to see the end of the exile. Like, wow, Daniel, what an amazing example of faithfulness. And this is his life. And he just begins to see a glimmer of the end of it. That's amazing devotion to me. And what an example for us when things don't look great. Isn't it easy to become discouraged or to want to go about things in our own way because this is just not working? So this is big stuff that Daniel contributed. So the first point I want to make about being faithful in exile is, what's your contribution? What's your bit? We just talked about Daniel's bit. And in our estimation, it's a really big bit, Daniel's bit, his life, what he contributed. When you think about it, Daniel's 12 chapters, I think, of the Bible, which is just a small part. And then when you even zoom out from there, Daniel's life is just a very small part of a much bigger pouring out of lives by God's people throughout all of the ages. He was just this one small part. And also, when you think about Daniel's devotion and his faithfulness, did his devotion bring an end to Israel's problems? Like, was he able to fix it? No, he wasn't. Did the Babylonian exile discipline fix their ways? Did they get it? They didn't get it. If you look back at his vision of the statue that represented the different kingdoms, it was one after another. Kingdoms rise and they fall, and that's the rhythm of history. And at the end of the vision, the stone that represents God's kingdom comes and it totally crushes the statue and all of the kingdoms. And they're all blown away like chaff, and there's no trace of them. And the only one that remains is God's kingdom, which turns into the huge mountain and fills the whole earth. And that's our hope. Everything else is going to come and go. It's going to rise and fall. It always, always has. And it will never stop until the end of time. So Daniel knew, like, these are the things that are going to happen. And there's just one kingdom that is never going to end. So even in knowing that, even in seeing that, Daniel knew, and he still lived this life of faithfulness. His contribution was still so worthwhile, and so is our own. Even when things just look like, oh, another oppressive regime, oh, another this, oh, another that, like, it is still worth it to live with faithfulness. Because the coming of God's kingdom is built on the living stones. And that's us. We're the living stones. And the coming of the kingdom is built on us, on our little lives. You know, you feel like, oh, this is just my tiny contribution. But it matters. It matters immensely. So you have to ask yourself, like, what does my bit look like today? And when I say, what does my bit look like today? I don't mean it in the sense of, like, you have to find out what you should be doing. Like, I have to find out what my role is. Like, should I be a pastor? Should I be a this? Should I be a that? What I mean is less of what should you be doing and more how should you be being, no matter what you are doing. You know, if you're a school teacher, or if you're a pastor, or if you're a stay-at-home mom, or if you work for a company, or if you shingle roofs, or whatever. The people of God have a particular way of being that sets them apart. And that's what I'm talking about. That's the contribution and the bit that I'm talking about. Your particular way of being. Because it's not the job of organizations or mega churches, and it's not the job of world governments to bring the kingdom. It's not their job. It is the job of the living stones. And if Jesus can come to earth and live for the time that he did and plant the seed he did, that's our model. That's what we do. And he certainly did not accomplish that by human power and force. He He was subversive in a way that had nothing to do with that kind of revolt. And that's our model. That's what we do now. And can you see the value of your faithfulness today, wherever you find yourself, even when it seems like nothing is going the way of the kingdom and nothing is changing? Can you see that it's still important and still be encouraged to be faithful? Even when, wouldn't it be easier if we could just have the power to institute all the things we want and to make everything God's way? Wouldn't it be better if we could just have the power to do that? Everything would be better. But the moment that we depend on earthly and human power to try and usher in God's kingdom on earth is the moment our efforts become hopelessly corrupt. Because no matter how good a person's intentions, if you are going to play the world's power game, there's already a set of rules. And you are not going to change the rules. The rules are going to change you. It is not going to work out. It is just a matter of time before any victory won by earthly power becomes just another system that is going to exalt itself, and it's going to hurt and oppress the image bearers of God, whoever they may be in that particular situation. It is just the way it works. And it's why Jesus didn't play the game according to the human categories. And it's why we can't either. That's not where our ultimate success lies. Let's look at some other examples of people that in the New Testament, take a look at people who continually saw Jesus's kingdom in terms of earthly power. We've talked about this some in other sermons, like this was a real problem. People had this idea of messiahship, and it was not Jesus's idea of messiahship. It just wasn't. Let's look at Mark chapter 10 here. James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus, saying to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant that we may sit, one on your right and one on your left, in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you're asking. And are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" They said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you shall drink, and you shall be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. But to sit on my right or on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." All right, so James and John here. James and John are interested here in earthly power. Commentators differ on what they thought was going to happen. Maybe they didn't even factor in that Jesus was going to suffer and die, and they just thought this was going to go the good old-fashioned way, and they were just going to take power and reestablish the kingdom. Some people think that they did understand that Jesus was going to suffer and die, but in a not so humiliating way, and that he was immediately going to be resurrected and then just come to power and establish his kingdom right there on earth. So they thought that this was like a sure, like soon going to happen type of thing. They had misunderstood the inauguration of God's kingdom, and they've taken the victory of the Messiah and they've co-opted it. They've applied it to the things that are most gratifying to themselves. That's dangerous business, because people still do that today. Take the victory of the Messiah and apply it to the thing that I would like to most see happen, because we're on the same team, right? So you just do the thing that I think is best, because we share the same mind and I already know what's best. So, and you've won the victory, so why not? You know, that's what they're doing here. They're seeking an end to their exile that is not possible here on earth until the fulfillment of all things. It's not possible in corruption and decay. So that's James and John. And Jesus's response is to point out to them exactly the opposite. He criticizes earthly power by reminding them that earthly authorities dominate their subjects. They lord it over them. And that it's not to be so among you. He says the way up in his kingdom is down. And he teaches it over and over and over again to people who want to exalt themselves and the things that they think is best via human power and earthly power. He's constantly teaching this. Think about the examples that Peter gives us. Peter, so rich with examples. In Matthew 16, we see Peter do the amazing thing of confessing the truth of who Jesus is. He says, you're the Messiah, you're the Christ, the anointed one, you're the Son of God. So you're reading this and you think, wow, Peter has got it. He understands that Jesus is the Messiah, the one who was to come. And a little bit further along, we see that maybe Peter has a little different idea of what Messiah is and what it means to be the Messiah, because Jesus tells his disciples that he's going to suffer and he's going to die and then he's going to rise again. And Peter does this thing that people in this culture just didn't do to their teachers that they followed. He rebukes him. He pulls him aside and he says, no, you will not suffer and die. May it never be so. And in ancient times, this just wasn't something you did. There was a lot of teacher and disciple relationships, and this was like out of line. And Jesus' reply is stern, and it's so shocking. It's shocking. It says, but he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's purposes, but men's purposes. And when you were a disciple of a teacher in Jesus' time, the disciples would walk behind their teacher when they were out in public. And it was a show of submission. It was a show of following them and their teaching and submitting to them. So in this context, Jesus is saying, get behind me. Like, follow me. I'm the teacher. You're the disciple. Get behind me and submit to what I have taught you, because you do not have my plans in mind. You have your own. You have the interests of men in your mind. Get behind me, is what he's telling him. And I think that most shocking here is that Jesus places Peter in the slot of Satan. He places him in the slot of the adversary. He's drawing a parallel between Peter and Satan, because Peter's offering the same temptation that Satan did back in the wilderness. He's offering him the same temptation, his own disciple. And this is the temptation. The temptation is all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, but without all the suffering and death. Just the cool, gratifying power part. That's what Jesus was tempted with in the wilderness. And Peter is saying, you don't need to suffer and die. You could just have the kingdom. That would be great. It's that temptation. The temptation offered by both Peter and Satan is the kingdom without the cross. It's the kingdom without the cross. If you think about that, it's a disaster. Everybody wants a kingdom. Nobody wants the cross. I mean, how human is that? We can relate to that. And what a disaster that results in. The power without the cross. That would have been the best thing to happen to the kingdom of darkness. If they could have made Jesus an earthly king, that would have been the best thing that they could do. To make him a king according to their rules, according to power on a human basis. People expecting the Jewish Messiah often misunderstood messiahship. They understood the triumph and the rule and the kingdom part, but views on the suffering and death part kind of varied. That wasn't so easy to incorporate into the ideas of messiahship that were prominent at the time. And probably one of the reasons that Jesus concealed the fact that he was the Messiah early on in his ministry, you know, those times where maybe he heals somebody and he tells them, don't tell anyone about me and don't tell anyone about this. Probably one of the reasons that he did this was because he had to set himself apart from the merely political saviors that had come before him and that would come after him. People were so familiar with this category of messiahship that He had to set himself apart from it. He couldn't fit into it. There's a commentator, Craig Keener, in his commentary on the New Testament, and he puts it this way really well. He says, Jesus' mission was completely different from any of the political views about Messiah circulating at the time. Messiahship was thus an inadequate category for him until he could define it by the character of his mission. His mission could be understood only retrospectively in the light of his death and his resurrection. So Jesus had to establish the true definition of Messiah because other people had come before him and sullied the word. And it wasn't a category that he was going to fit into. He had his own category, and he always does. He has his own category for us. And when we allow him to work through it, it's like nothing the world has. And that's what sets us apart. That's why we look different. So Jesus had to establish the true definition of Messiah, characterized by love, by suffering, by death to self, favor for the broken, favor for the downtrodden, the sick, the people that nobody wanted anything to do with, the poor, rather than appealing to the powerful or appealing to their own power and just trying to take over and revolt. And ultimately, he characterized his mission as Messiah by a shameful death as a criminal that he didn't deserve. And it was through that death and through the cross and through that laying down of his life that brought him to exaltation. That's the model for true power, kingdom power. He establishes the way to the crown, and it's through the cross. And there's no other way. It's through the cross. It's through the laying down of your life and carrying your own cross. That's the example that he has set for us. And so I'll just leave you with a couple of questions to think about. As exiles, do we ever, can we, fall into wanting to bring God's kingdom without the cross? By force and by power and by playing the world's games according to the world's rules, rather than carrying our crosses daily, which is the most subversive thing we can do in our culture, is to carry our crosses daily and to lay down our lives. There's nothing more subversive than that because no one wants to do it. Everybody just wants the power to make things easy. So can we lay down our lives? Can we be the living sacrifices through which the kingdom comes? We can. You know, he's given us the power. He's given us the spirit. He's empowered us to live like he did. Can we be like Daniel in the tension that exists between living as an exile with wisdom, humility, compassion, even serving kingdoms that don't serve us out of a place of love? Living between the tension of that and being faithful to God's kingdom as we wait for its fulfillment. That's, I heard it referred to as like the knife's edge of faithfulness. This is like, you can't apply a formula to this. It's moment to moment living with the Spirit and listening to him. And that is powerful beyond anything the world has to offer. You can't take that away from somebody, and there's nothing you can do to them to make them stop. It's the model that he's set for us. Our lives and our missions should be characterized by the kind of subversion that comes through the power of the Spirit. That's our power. And it's going to lead us differently than the power of the world leads the people of the world. So think about that this week. I'm trying to work it out too. I just don't know exactly how all the time. But I want to. I'm trying. I'm praying. And I hope you'll do the same. So let's go ahead and pray. Lord, we know that this stuff doesn't come by a formula, a list of do this, don't do this, all these different things, like this is the way to make it perfect. We just submit ourselves to you, and we want to hear your voice, and we want to obey your word, because there's things you've already said to us that we know to be true. Lord, help us to be obedient, to submit our lives to you, and to find the joy in it, because there is so much joy in it, Lord. Help us to not influence around us through worldly power and through human power, but through the power of the Spirit, Lord. Help us to live humbly and to love you, to love each other, Lord, powerfully. And I pray that you would just work in us and through us for the glory of your name. In Jesus' name, amen.